Hello, welcome to this edition of the Bearcats Blogcast. My name is Scott, joined by Chris Baines and Matt Ober, the three-man group back together. How's it going, Chris?
I really couldn't be better. We're going to focus on the football part of the podcast today. So, UC coming off a thrashing of East Carolina on Saturday. The Hoops team is back on track. Matt, how you doing today?
I am doing very well. It's good to be back talking about the Bearcats. You know, even though this is my busy season of the year, it's good that I could, you know, carve out a day where we could get this done. Because there's a lot to talk about with the Bearcats right now. And for a shocking, level, like, it's all positive. So that'll be new.
It's got to be a nice change of pace in the last couple of years. Like, you know, taking a break from the busy retailer season, not to talk about, you know, the depression of a 4-8 year and the major issues that they're going to have to address in the offseason. But hey, they're 10-2. They've won the double digits for the seventh time in the program, and things are really, really looking up.
Yeah, I mean, this year has been fantastic, and nobody expected it. That's what makes it so interesting, because it was so out of the blue. They're clearly a year or two ahead of schedule, but I'm not complaining.
Yeah.
Hey, even our pie-in-the-sky projections preseason were like, oh, maybe they can get to 8 wins, maybe 9, and like they just go blow out 10-2. That clearly, like, one of the best teams in the entire league. That's so close to the finishing in second in the division. And they gave UCF a run for their money. But, like, overall, just, like, a gigantic improvement. And let's touch on the ECU game before we look too wide. So this game was pretty much every improvement, like, in one. Like, you had the quarterback play amazing, and Desmond Ridder 335 yards, 4 touchdowns. That running game that was unbelievable. The defense was, like, lights out. One of their best performances of the entire season. Like, East Carolina had really no chance and had what one big play was their entire offense. And the Bearcats just completely smash them 56-6. What were your, like, overall impressions of this one, Matt?
My overall impressions were it's not hard to see why they fired Scotty, because ECU is not a good team, and UC did, you know, what we've been asking them to do for the last couple of years, where they struggled to take care of business against the teams where they are clearly better. That was not an issue in this game at all, and that really hasn't been an issue this year at all. I mean, with the one notable exception of the SMU game, they have taken care of business and dominated the teams they're supposed to dominate. And that's such a welcome change from the Tuberville era that it just fills my heart up with happiness.
Yeah, their drive chart is ended in touchdown, turnover on downs, touchdown, 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 turnover on downs, touchdown, punt, punt, touchdown, and a fumble. And those last few were pretty much done with the second and third team offense. Yeah, it was just dominating performance start to finish. It was just a lot of eye candy, I felt like. My biggest, broadest impressions was, you know, that was a nice, comfortable way to kind of end the year. You know, a dominating defensive performance, the offense having no real issue moving the ball up and down the field. Like, Khalil Lewis was in the middle of the field with no ECU defender around him, like, 3 or 4 or 5 times. Like, ECU had no answers for UC's offense. And it was nice to see, you know, some of the seniors go out on a positive note, Hayden Moore go out on a positive note. It was cool to see Giannis Rogers and Josh Wiley getting a lot of playing time. Arquan Bush had a hell of a game. Really kind of a nice stamp on the season as we kind of head into bowl season and, you know, look forward to next year.
I kind of overlooked Khalil Lewis. 9 catches, 203 yards, 3 touchdowns. As you mentioned, Chris, completely unguardable. DeGuara had, like, a good game, 64 yards, a touchdown. like pretty much every single phase of the game. Like your two young running backs go over 100 yards. Like it was really nothing really to pull apart here. And like East Carolina is a team that no matter how good or bad East Carolina has been, UC has really struggled with them since the Pirates joined the conference. And after the blowout last year, it was good to get that like blowout back on UC's side this year. And like flipping to the defense, Allers, he had solid stats in his other starts. He went 8-22, 184, got sacked twice, threw a pick six. UC did a really great job of just completely shutting them down.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, that's become par for the course for this defense is, you know, it cannot be said enough how good this defense has been from where they started last year. Like, there's no parallel for this level of turnaround in a single season in recent college football history. And I'm only being half facetious. Like, there are not many examples of a team going from being, you know, in the hundreds in S&P defense to, what do they end up, 25th, 26th, something like that?
I think like 19th. I think they were even higher than that.
I mean, that is a remarkable turnaround. And we all thought the defense would be the strength of the team. We just didn't. We were right on the basics. We were wrong on the magnitude. Because they've been much better than I anticipated.
Yeah, just in terms of like stop rate, like they're in the top what, like three in the nation. Like the run defense finished third in S&P Plus. That could probably still change given some of these title games. But East Carolina ran for 83 yards and 2.5 yards a carry. Completely dominating. Marquise Copeland had two sacks. Ty's Sponseller had a sack and like mop-up duty. Like it just did great numbers for the defense. And like as to your greater point, Matt, it's like an unbelievable turnaround from last season when it seemed like they were a lot of bend, and then they would break and give up some big yards and big points. And this year that didn't happen. They were one of the best defenses like by far. And if they started like a little higher and like the efficiency numbers, like they could have had even better rated defense, I think. That's just one of the little like things against the S&P numbers.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing with the defense was just the complete change of tactic from Marcus Freeman and the staff. So last year they were very much a defense that was catching offenses. They weren't very aggressive. They didn't dictate, you know, they didn't challenge routes. They didn't really challenge runs. You know, they played very loose coverage. They were a team that if you were just patient, you could get your 4 or 5 yards a pop every single play and just kind of walk down the field on a 20-play drive. And that happened numerous times. The Navy game, for example, this year, a complete 180. Like, this defense challenges everything. It contests everything. And they play so much, they put so much faith in the secondary to play, you know, tight man-to-man coverage. And, you know, that allows them, that frees up resources to, you know, play the run much better, to rush the passer much better, to be much more aggressive in blitzing. And all of that kind of came together and created this really, really great UC defense. And the best thing about it is you're going to lose the two big guys in the middle, which is a big blow, no doubt. But everybody else is coming back. So this group is going to be special for years to come.
Yeah, and I think that was one of the concerns people see going into the offseason. You lose Copeland and Broughton up the middle. You're gonna lose Kimoni Fitz, but you get back like Malik Vann's back, Michael Pitts is back, like everyone at the second and third level is back. So anecdotally, you maybe give up a little more on the ground up the middle, but you know, I trust Marcus Freeman to make the necessary adjustments to, you know, instead of just relying on his front four to get penetration, you know, maybe sending Brian Wright a little more, maybe sending Perry Young a little more at the middle to kind of help stem that loss. It doesn't really seem like that big of a concern to me. And really, this defense could be even better next season.
Yeah, like that would be the expectation, at least. Like, even though you do lose, like as you mentioned, like a big part of your line, I guess that's going to be the biggest worry going into the offseason. Even though some of the backups have, like, decent, like, stats and short bursts. But, like, your entire secondary and, like, a linebacking core coming back, it's, like, such a big boost. So at least you're stable on that end. So we've seen, like, last year and the year before, being, like, shaky in the secondary, and the linebacking core really killed the Bearcats, even though they had a solid defensive line. So if you can't guard, you're in trouble. And it helped this year that they were just able to rush their linemen a lot, because those guys require double teams. And if you didn't double team them, Broughton would end up with two sacks like he did in this game.
Yeah, and one of the most interesting things about this defense in terms of how it's progressed over the course of the season is how many more guys are playing now than they did at the beginning of the year, especially with the interior positions. So at the beginning of the year, it was Copeland and it was Broughton 95% of the snaps in the UCLA game. As the season has progressed, the backups at those positions have gotten much, much better and much, much more productive. So you got Curtis Brooks, he's probably the best one of the bunch that's coming back, but you also got Marcus Brown and Elijah Ponder, who both played a ton of snaps down the stretch this year. They're not going to be able to replicate the production of those two of your outgoing senior defensive tackles, but like this group is going to get compared to the Derek Wolfe, John Hughes, interior line. The difference between this group and that group is Wolfe and Hughes didn't really have backups. Like they were the guys and they played very, very well. And you had Jordan Stepp behind them, but it was a 3-man rotation. They go 5 deep at defensive tackle with this group. And that's going to be, that's a huge benefit going forward for next year when, Broughton and Copeland are going to be getting paid for doing what they do.
Yeah, and plus, like, they have, like, Tucky, he ended up playing a lot down the stretch, like, to your point, and he played pretty well this season. And just, like, looking at their run stuffs, like, it's a ton on the defensive line, like, up and down the roster with the depth. And, like, Pitts had a really fine season, too, as, like, the unheralded guy, because he wasn't a senior. And like, returning your secondary, like, especially Wiggins, like, with the way he broke out this year, like, he's, like, the anchor of your defense now.
Yeah, there's really not any concerns defensively. I mean, I guess the only thing to really be keep an eye on is if Marcus Freeman actually stays, right? Like, it doesn't seem like he's been on any list so far. It's still early. I mean, we're still in November. But, that's the only real concern I have going into the offseason. And I hate to kind of, like, put that little damper on everything. But, I mean, that's something we just got to kind of keep an eye on.
No, that's absolutely right. That is the thing you have to watch with this coaching staff going forward is Freeman. And we could touch on Luke Fickell's situation later on. You can never be 100% confident as a Cincinnati fan. We have rode this roller coaster too many times to not be a little uneasy, but I'm not. It doesn't feel like previous situations. I'll just leave it at that. But Marcus Freeman is an extremely hot name in the coordinator game because of what he's done with this defense. Like I said, there is no parallel for what he has done with this group from year one to year two. He is still extremely young as a coach. He has not called defenses for many years at all. He has implemented a really unique and interesting system here at Cincinnati. But his name is going to be out there. The question is, does a school like Ohio State, all the Ohio State fans want to fire Greg Schiano into the moon. Like that's their kind of mood right now. And if they do that, I'm not sure that, bringing Freeman in is going to placate the masses of delusional Ohio State fans just because they don't pay attention to anybody but them. And they don't really know what has happened with this group. So if I'm Marcus Freeman and I want to maximize my bang for the buck, I stay for another year. I run it back and make this defense even better. You know, put out a top 10 unit and then see what happens.
Yeah, I guess like the only concern in that scenario is, let's go back. In my mind, I'm conditioned to believe that any successful head coach at UC is going to leave after 3 years. So I already have the mindset that Fickell is gone after 2019. He'll be somewhere else. There's going to be this year's carousel is a little weird. Like Auburn's underperforming, USC's underperforming. Those very high level positions all over the country are either not coming open this year, or those that are underperforming compared to expectations just aren't coming open. Like Clay Helton's back at USC. Gus Malzahn's probably going to stay there at Auburn. Next year, though, I mean, who knows what's going to happen? Who knows if those are going to open up? And Fickell, if he comes back and wins another 10-plus games, he should be one of the hottest coaches heading out into the marketplace. If I'm Marcus Freeman, you probably have to kind of see that in the headlights and have to wonder, does it make sense for me to jump to, like, an Ohio State now? Or do I ride with Fickell next year at whatever high-level job he potentially goes to, or do I leave then? It's a lot of moving parts going on with Marcus Freeman that he's going to probably have to think about going forward.
It's really going to just come down to, like, the opportunity. It's like, no matter what, like, he'll get paid whatever he chooses to do. Probably not at UC as much. But, like, if he takes a bigger job, he'll definitely get a boost. And if he stays with Fickell, wherever Fickell ends up, if he ends up out of Cincinnati this year or next year, he'll definitely get a pay boost. So it's just taking the best opportunity for him. Which, and I do wonder how much, like, he wants to stay together with Fickell. Because if they stay together, like, and, like, the defense improved again next year, like, he'd definitely be in line for, like, a lot better job than some of the ones that have opened up so far. Like what you mentioned, Chris. So if like next year, if like Urban Meyer doesn't come back, like he'd definitely be one of the rumors or candidates for the Ohio State job for sure. Especially if UC goes 10-2 again.
Yeah, I mean, like that is probably the logical destination for both Fickell and Freeman. I'm more worried about Freeman going this year just because Ohio State's defense has so drastically underperformed for its talent level. And they have the kind of, you know, it's Ohio State. They can get whoever they need, but they have the kind of personnel that will really suit the scheme that Freeman is developing here at Cincinnati, where your emphasis is more on speed rather than size. Like you obviously have the big defensive line, but like this defense is so great because it is so multiple and it allows you to not change personnel groupings for basically anything. Like you can just kind of run with what you got, and you have basically hybrid outside linebacker positions that are part safeties, part outside linebackers, and that allows you to, you know, play the run tough, which the defense has done, but also be extremely stingy against the pass. And it's a very unique scheme that Freeman has developed, and he's got everything he needs to run it very well and at a high level at Cincinnati. It's just a matter of will he choose to do that next year? And we really don't know.
Yeah, and one thing we don't really know either is how much he's exactly being paid. Like, I've heard rumors, and I don't know how valid they are, that UC's assistant pool is a little either on the mid-side or lower side of the AAC. I don't know how much, like I said, I don't know if that's true or whatever. You got to imagine that's going to expand this offseason regardless, and you're going to give Fickell a raise. But, I mean, if he's making, like, somewhere as, like, a mid-tier defensive coordinator in this conference, I mean, that could only just push him out the door faster.
Yeah, I mean, like, you can understand where he was pegged in terms of pay scale based on his previous experience, but we're 2 years in, and He has done outstanding. He is going to get a massive pay raise if he chooses to stay. Regardless, he's going to get a pay raise this year. It's a matter. The question is, will he get it? It's a matter of what institution's name will be on the check. That's basically. Right.
That's the thing with coordinators is like those come open at like almost every big school, every single year. So it'd just be really like he's the one to watch. I think. Like, do you think? Like, on the other side of the ball, do you think that Fickell should look to do anything with the offense, or do you think like they're just going to run it back with Den Brock? Because I like the offense.
Ooh, did that's well a compl- at times. That's a complicated question.
So the offense did well in times, but overall, like, they were still in the bottom 75 2 years in a row. Like, I know they had a young quarterback, but I don't know. I just really don't like his schemes too much.
Matt, you want to go?
Yeah, I would like to see somebody in who could maximize Desmond Ritter's copious gifts, because he has a lot of them. He's got a rocket arm. He can make pretty much any throw that you need him to make. He is a gifted north-south runner, but their inability to fully integrate him into the running game was a notable problem all year long. Most of his big runs came on, you know, scramble plays where he just kind of had to make something happen. There was no real designed element to how he was integrated into the running game. And if this offense is to reach its full potential, he has to be more involved in the running game. And there has to be a little bit more cohesion between the running game and the passing game. Because, yeah, Den Brock's offense reminded me a lot of Mike Bajakian's offense back when Butch Jones was here. It was a running game and it was a passing game, and never would the two meet, right? They were two separate entities the entire year, and that really kind of puts a limit on what you can do as an offense, because if the defense can tell based on alignment and personnel groups what you're going to be doing, you're giving them an advantage. And in this era of football, it's just, it doesn't make sense to telegraph things so obviously when, you know, there's so much evidence that spreading teams out and getting your athletes in isolated situations against other athletes is the best way to attack. I mean, look at Central Florida and what they did to UC's vaunted defense. They doesn't matter what the way they align means that regardless of what defense you're in, everything's man to man, because they stretch you out from sideline to sideline and they make you cover every single receiver, and that is very difficult for a defense. And on the opposite side, UC doesn't really do that, not even close. So I would like to see a change in offensive coordinator, whether that's promoting someone from within or going with an outside hire. I don't know, but I have serious reservations about Den Brock still.
Yeah, I know Scott and I, we talked about this last week on the podcast. I'm so torn on Den Brock, because on the one hand, I feel like he approaches the game with a solid game plan. He's going to lean on his strengths. He's going to try to get the running game going. He'll get Ritter out there in space occasionally to get the ball downfield. He's done a nice job getting the tight ends involved this year. He's improved them in terms of S&P plus 25 points in the rankings. He's working with a wide receiver unit that doesn't have a lot of playmakers. He's working with an offensive line that's patchwork at best. That being said, I don't see the creativity. I feel like all season long we were asking, why aren't you getting Mike Boone the ball as a receiver more? Where are the screens? Against UCF, which is a perfect comparison, Matt, you saw how Josh Heupel schemed his receivers open. Like, it didn't matter that UC had an Alabama-level defense or a UConn-level defense. He identified areas of the field that he could try to exploit, and he attacked them. Whereas UC was just grinding through the inside zone all game long while the receivers were getting locked up on the outside. You know, where were the sags? Where were the slants? where were the slip screens? Where were the tunnel screens? Where were all of those? Where UC could take advantage of the over-aggression of UCF's defense. And it took Denbrock until like the halfway through the second quarter and after halftime to really make those adjustments. And by then it was way too late. So I would part of me is like, I'd like to see what he does with a receiving core that has Geddes and Wiley and Rollins and maybe Muge and potentially Michi Harris, all of those younger players at their core, as well as an offensive line that's actually made up of five offensive linemen and not just a bunch of converted like hockey players and walk-ons. But the other part of me is like, even if they do that, even if he has those weapons available, is the scheme and is the mindset going to change? And I don't know if it is. And so I'm kind of leaning towards the try to maybe bring in some new blood there. As long as you can identify a good talent, I think the opportunity is there.
Because to play devil's advocate, like and keep like bringing him back, it's like you did see the offense improve, but then like on the flip side, like they improved against the really bad teams. Like they put up a lot of
exactly.
points on like Ohio and UConn and Tulane, and then in East Carolina. Then when they got like the serious games, like Central Florida, they didn't perform very well. SMU, Temple, UCLA, Miami. I know Miami was like an asterisk game, but still, like their numbers in that game were really terrible all around. And like the explosiveness was there at times, but then it would disappear. And like it just seemed the passing game. I don't know if they really toned it down, like because Ritter was new, but it wasn't good last year. And you had like a 3-year starter pretty much, and Hayden Moore. Like this year, they only had three receivers who had double-digit targets. And it just made their offense really kind of predictable.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, at this point, it's not about becoming a good offense or an average offense or whatever. Like, from here until Ritter's gone, like, conference championship is the goal. Conference championship is the expectation. And I'm not sure you can win a conference title in this conference playing offense like this, being so predictable. Because in the two games where it really, really mattered in the division, the offense was not didn't come to play. And part of that is that Temple plays really good defense, and part of it is that UCF had a really good scheme. But UC didn't have any answers for what they were doing. And that's the bigger problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those situations where if you know that you have, like, look at, like I mean, let's look at, like, what Brian Kelly did when he came here after D'Antonio. He probably didn't have the weapons and the skill players that he expected to bring in, but he just out-schemed offenses to maximize their abilities. And I don't know if we're seeing that out of Denbrock. I mean, I think, like we said, he gets credit for bringing the tight ends into the fold a little better than they did last year. I mean, the offense as a whole is better, but you know, to your point, Scott, they lit up awful defenses. I mean, they were padding their stats against awful defenses, and I'm a little concerned because you know we're comfortable with Denbrock. We know what we have with him. He doesn't need to create an Oklahoma level of offense. You know, the defense is so good where they can get away with being an average to above average offense. But then it comes into games where you're playing like a Central Florida where you need to have that offense on the table. And you need to be able to hit those buttons to score touchdowns at will. And I don't know if he has those in his playbook.
Well, no, it's about margin for error. That's the issue. UCF played some really terrible first half this year, including the first quarter against UC. But it didn't matter in the end because they have such a vast margin of error from how good their offense is that it allows them to get out of situations where a team like UC, if they get in those situations, they're just dead. And that's the issue. You need to find a way to get more offense so that you can find your way out of these situations.
Yeah, like that's like the real thing with the future. It's like you have a quarterback who's going to progress and grow. And it's how fast can they get him progressed and like how much can he improve? It's like just looking ahead at their schedule next year. Like they play, like it goes up a notch, like with some of the defenses they play, just in the non-conference. So I believe Marshall's on the schedule. Marshall has like a top 10 S&P defense. Like obviously they play Ohio State, who's extremely talented, even if they're bad. So you're going to face like some tough challenges. And now all these teams know at least something about Ridder. And Houston comes back on the schedule next year. Like they won't have Ed Oliver, but like they're obviously they have a ton of talent too, and like their coaching staff is like overhauling under Major Applewhite. So I think next year is really, really important. And I don't know. I personally haven't seen it from Den Brock. Like you don't need to have like a top 10 offense like Memphis or UCF, but you need like something like the 50s or 60s. Like even like Temple, like they had the 60th ranked offense. Like you give UC a boost like that to just like a good offense instead of like below average. And like this team is like a definite contender to win the conference.
Yeah, and that's they definitely are, and that's the goal, and that's the expectation. So you need to hire accordingly, and I'm not sure that Den Brock's going to be able to get you to that level. And it's not that Den Brock's offenses can't get you there. It's just going to be much harder to do that playing the style of football that Den Brock likes to play. His style of football decreases your margin for error, flat out. It really does. If you can't run the ball successfully on first down, and in the games where UC struggled, they couldn't. Temple comes to mind. If you can't run the ball successfully on first down, you are against, you know, you're up against it the entire game. And this offense has shown flashes of being able to kind of break out of that, where they, you know, suddenly pass a lot on first downs. But that's in games where it doesn't matter. In games where they are playing a bad defense and they know they're playing a bad defense, you know, they'll light them up then. But you need to have that same mentality in every game. And UC didn't this year. I mean, they set out to beat Central Florida by running the ball. And Central responded by putting 9 guys in the box and blitzing the fuck out of them all game long. And there was no response. That's more than a little worrisome.
And, like, on the larger issue, like, Chris mentioned the playmakers earlier. You have a lot in your backfield. Like, Warren, obviously, coming back. The two freshmen, Thomas and McClelland. Who knows about Dokes if he comes back. But just those three guys. Like, you have to find a way to get those guys all involved. Because what we saw from McClelland and Thomas, at least in the East Carolina game, like, there's way too much potential there to really run a one-back system. Like, you have to find ways of getting all those guys the ball. And we still saw really nothing from McClelland and Thomas in the passing game at all. Like, Michael Warren had 24 catches. Like, something like that's got to change because, like, those are your best players coming back. And you just have to get them open. Like, Central Florida, like, what they did with their running back. I'm, like, blanking on his name. McCray. Like, they got him the ball in so many different ways the back half of the season. They were, like, pretty much unstoppable. Like, if you focus on Milton, McCray would have a huge run. And, like against UC, they just put their backs out, like him and Killens, and they just big burned the linebackers. Like, UC's
capable of that. I think it's a good point. Sorry, go ahead, Scott. I cut you off.
No, that was it. Go ahead, Chris.
No, I mean, I was going to agree with you. I mean, I just switching gears a little bit. I'm a fan of the Chicago Bears. The 8-3 Chicago Bears, just to make that stat known. Matt Nagy, when he came in, he made it a point to put Jamar Howard and Tariq Cohen on the field at the same time. Howard is more the between the tackles back, and Cohen can pretty much do everything. Why can't you do the same thing with Mike Warren and Charles McClelland, or Tavion Thomas and Charles McClelland? So you at least have two of those playmakers on the field at the same time. But yeah, to your point, Scott, we only saw really one of that trio at any given time on the, you know, this year, and it's a little surprising, because if you look at if you were to rank the position groups between running back, receiver, and tight end, the talent is far and away in that running back group compared to the other two. So why wouldn't you want to put more of those playmakers on the field if you possibly can? And we didn't see any of that, really. So yeah, that is something that, yeah, that's a good point, Scott. I'd like to see more of that going forward next year.
Well, it's not just that the running backs are really deep. Like, the tight end group is incredibly deep. You have Wiley, you have Leonard Taylor, you have DeGuara, who nobody saw the season come out of. Then you have all of your blocking tight ends. Like, the tight end group is stacked. Like, that is the tight end group that most AAC, you know, coordinators would kill for. Same thing with the running back group. The receiver group doesn't have the name brand recognition as a lot of these, and most of them weren't, you know, highly thought of recruits, but that's still a pretty good group. There are infinite possibilities for this offense going forward. Between the legs of Desmond Ridder, the arm of Desmond Ridder, this talent that they have assembled in all these different, you know, position groups. Like, you can have an extremely creative, vibrant offense with this group. I just don't think that Denbrock's going to be the guy who, you know, makes it come to fruition. I'd like to see him, you know, try something else, try a different quarterback. Like, the guy that I keep thinking of is Brian Wright, the offensive coordinator for Toledo. He's been there for a couple of years, and Toledo has pretty consistently been one of the top 10 offenses in the country year after year, despite having kind of constant turnover at running back, at quarterback, and the receiver position. It doesn't really matter. He seems to crank out a very highly thought of, very well-regarded offense every single year. And he does it with not nearly as much talent as he would walk into if he came down to Cincinnati. So, like, that's the kind of move I would like to see made. I'm just not sure it's going to happen.
Yeah, and I think that's the major concern or question mark if you're Luke Fickell. You know you have a potential top 15, top 10 defense going into 2019. You're probably staring at like a 50 to 75 offense if all things stay the same. Do you risk going after a new hire and potentially seeing that bump up into the you know, 25 to 50 range? Or do you make the wrong hire? You know, you hire like a Zach Taylor or something, and it just collapses under the feet of you, because you are losing quite a bit in terms of stability in this offseason. Like, something like three or four of your starting offensive linemen are graduating. You lose Khalil Lewis. There could be a complete failure on the offense next season if he makes the wrong hire. So it's an interesting question that Fickell's going to have to answer this offseason.
Definitely. The coordinator positions, like, obviously behind Fickell. Like, Fickell's number one, like, what happens with him. But then, like, the coordinator positions are, like, definitely number two, because, like, changes seems like it could be coming. Or you just bring everybody back and, like, hopefully you get better next year. Do you guys want to have anything more to touch on with that, or do you want to talk about the Fickell rumors? Just dive in that head first.
Let's get it over with.
So it seems like right now the biggest Fickell rumor is that he's a candidate to end up at Louisville if they don't get the Appalachian State head coach, Satterfield, which seems to be the hot name on the market. But other jobs will probably open. But like, that one seems interesting, at least, because Fickell definitely has ties to the area. And, like, he's said repeatedly he doesn't really want to leave Ohio. And that seems like the biggest job close to Ohio he could get if he wasn't Ohio State.
Well, Scott, you're in Louisville. What do you think about that?
I kind of think he should hold out for something better.
Ding, ding, ding.
But it's also hard to pass up a lot of money. It really depends on his motivation.
I mean, I feel like first of all, it says a lot about Louisville that their heir apparent, their golden boy, Jeff Braum, turned them down to stay at a Purdue gig that, you know, is what, mid-tier in the P5? Trending upward, but still a lot of work to be done. And I feel like if you're Fickle, we talked about this before, you have the opportunity to come back with a loaded roster to win even more games next year and position yourself to be a candidate for a top-tier program, be it in Ohio if Urban Meyer leaves, or you know, maybe somewhere in the SEC or somewhere else in the Big Ten. It seems like if you're Fickle, you're jumping ship a little too quickly to go after Louisville.
So my point of view on this is, what do we really know about Luke Fickle in terms of his decision-making when it comes to jobs? So he had been an assistant in Ohio State for almost two decades, like 15 years. I think he graduated in the late 90s, was a grad assistant. Then he kind of worked his way up until he was eventually defensive coordinator and in a position to take over the interim job when Ted Tugate happened, right? So at any point in between that, because throughout this entire process, his name has, you know, he has been a hot name. And there have been plenty of OSU-branded assistants who have gone on to take lower-tier jobs, you know, mostly in the MAC. Like if you are the running back coach at Ohio State, like, you can take that and leverage your way into being the head coach at Kent or Akron or something, like a school like that. Like, that is a very logical track that a lot of people have taken, and a lot of people have taken that track and not succeeded. Like, Fickle could have done that at any point in the last 10 years, but he chose not to. So that tells me that he is a little bit more discerning in what kind of opportunities he is going to be willing to take. And when this UC job opened, with all of its resources, with all of its inherited advantages in terms of the recruiting grounds that he inherited, with the recent success of the program, like, he saw UC as an opportunity for him to take a program that had proven, demonstrated ability to reach a higher level, to play at a much greater level than what they're playing at currently, right? In the throes of the Tuberville era. And he chose to take that opportunity because he saw the support, he saw the resources, he knew a lot about the program because he had been so close and recruited Cincinnati very closely for years, right? So this is a very discerning guy. He is not Todd Graham. He is not going to leap at the first open job. And it's because of that I don't think he is going to go to Louisville. Because at this point, Louisville is a mess. Your main benefactor has disgraced himself. You had to change the name of your stadium because of that. You had the Adidas fiasco. Like, there are so many things that are going against them. You don't really know if this athletic director is going to be there long term, because the last guy just kind of blew himself up. Like, there is nothing about this situation that screams stability. And I think that Fickle is a high achiever who wants to achieve, you know, a level of success that is not going to be readily apparent at Louisville. That doesn't mean that Louisville can't throw a fuck ton of money at the problem and get him over. I just think that it's going to take many, many Brinks trucks to get him to move from UC to go to Louisville for this job. That doesn't mean that Fickle is going to be here forever. I don't think he will be. But I think he's going to wait for the right opportunity.
I think the top thing that stands out to me, like, if he were to go, is that it's, like, as I mentioned, it's, like, the most, like, local big job that's open now in a bigger conference. And you could probably argue, like, Cincinnati and Louisville were on the same level. That's probably a fact. Like, then Louisville's broken away to the ACC, and, like, their opportunities are just so much bigger. And, like, 2 years ago, they were in the top, like, five. Like, obviously, their roster's changed a ton. But, like, with his, like, ties in Ohio, like, he could just keep recruiting the same type of guys he's recruiting into Cincinnati. And being in the ACC, maybe get into some more doors. Obviously, he doesn't have a problem with that, given, like, his history at Ohio State. But, like, that would be just my biggest concern is the money. Obviously, they would pay more. And it would be an opportunity to get to a power conference, which who knows how important that is to him. At least right now.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't think that Fickle's going to be here long term, but I think he's going to be much more patient with what he is willing to, what jobs he's going to actually take a real crack at. Because he's going to be mentioned with a lot of jobs, especially in the Big Ten. Every Big Ten job that comes open until he leaves is going to have him one or two on those hypothetical top 10 lists of coaches for those jobs, just because of where he's been. But I think he just seems like a guy who's going to wait for the perfect opportunity and take that when it comes. And, like, Ohio State is obviously the one that everybody's going to think of. But Urban Meyer doesn't really seem to be going anywhere. And then there's also the matter of, at Ohio State, a lot of people don't really have fond memories of 2011 and don't think that highly of Fickell because of it. That's not something that can't be overcome, but that's just another factor to think about. The other job that I think would make a lot of sense for him is Michigan State, if and when Antonio retires.
Wait for that.
Yeah, there's a lot of crossover between that Michigan State staff and how they run things and how things were run under Jim Tressel, which is, you know, he's on that tree. Like, he's also on the Urban tree, but he's really a Tressel guy. Because that's where he got to start, and that's who he learned so much from. Like, that, he was on the Tressel staff for a decade. That doesn't really just go away.
Yeah, I feel like in some kind of weird way, because UC had such a dramatic and drastic turnaround this year, and Fickell got the AAC Coach of the Year award, which we'll go through in a little bit, and he got on everyone's radars by winning 10 games. It kind of set himself. It kind of set him up to, in probably his mind, get one of those Ohio State or Michigan State or hell, I don't know, Wisconsin type jobs after 2019. Where in his mind, Louisville almost seems like he's kind of settling a little bit. Now I know Louisville has a lot of resources available, but, you know, to your point, Matt, I mean they've taken a lot of hits in terms of perception and financial backing and stuff like that recently. They still print money. They print money like the best of the P5, but there's still a lot of underlying, you know, cracks in that foundation that I don't know if Fickell really wants to deal with right now, he's established himself to turn around the Cincinnati program. He's shown his future employers that he can tap into the Cincinnati market, a very desirable Cincinnati market that we all know Ohio State's been trying to get at for the last several years. Michigan State's done a solid job of doing that over the last couple of years. They typically go Toledo before they go Cincinnati. He's setting himself up to be the perfect replacement for Urban Meyer or Mark D'Antonio or is it Paul Christ at Wisconsin? I don't know. He's setting himself up for a big payday next year if he just kind of sits tight.
So whenever he leaves, he'll get a big payday. I think the big difference between him and some of the other coaches they've had is, like, he's already had, like, a proven track record of success. Like, at least as a coordinator and, like, as a big flashy name being at Ohio State. And, like, given how their defense has fallen off since he's left, I mean, that's, like, another point in his favor. And with how UC improved so much, like, it would just be really interesting to see what comes open and how seriously he's a candidate at some of these other places.
Yeah, and that's the really interesting thing about coaches at this level is you can stay too long, right? The perfect example of this is Neil Brown at Troy. Like, he was a guy who was mentioned for everything. And you don't really hear his name anymore. Because the percent, like, it's kind of like, it's kind of like a college player who comes back for a second year instead of going to the NBA after the first year, like the first middling year, and then comes back for the second year, and everybody's like, oh, we have more film on him, we know more about him, and he's not really that good. You there is an element of you have to strike while the iron is hot. But, like, there's so many competing factors, especially in Fickle's case, because his name, he's got a hot name right now. And, but, so, like, he can cash in on that now and double his pay scale, double the assistant, you know, salary pool for his assistants, bring everybody with him. He can do that tomorrow if he wanted to. But on the other side of that, you are now poised to stay the hot name for 2-3 years with this group because everybody's staying. Like, there's not a lot of turnover. Like, there's some turnover on the offensive line and there's some turnover on the defensive line, both of which are problems. I think the offensive line is – I think it's going to be better next year than it is this year just because they will have more talented players, even if they are not – you know, even if there's a continuity issue and they're kind of rough for the first couple of games. I think that's more likely to happen than they come out firing on all cylinders. But the defense should be fine regardless. And, like, this is a group – like, there are marquee names on the schedule next year that will allow you to kind of catapult your name into the, you know, into the higher echelons of the sport and stay there for a couple of years because you have, like – UC is still on the launch pad. Like, the engines are firing, but they're still on the pad. And wait for that to take off, you can, your name will just stay in the conversation for 2-3 years.
Right, and that's kind of my point, is that, like, I feel like in this cycle, because there's not a lot of monster names in the top echelon of jobs coming open, there's not that trickle-down effect. Really that much. I mean, you're seeing like the mid-tier jobs kind of coming open, like the UNCs, the Texas Techs, the Louisvilles, the Georgia Techs, all those. Those are jobs that Fickle can wait, doesn't need to take, because if he has another season like this or better, he won't be just kind of in the mix with, you know, a Neil Brown, a Scott Satterfield, a Jeff Brom. He's going to be the guy that that programs are going to go after, and he can pretty much, he could probably name his next job if he wanted to, starting next season.
Yeah, of course, and of course, like, the flip side of that is, like, kind of what Matt said earlier. It's like, you stay around too long, you take, like, a losing season, and, like, your stock goes down. Or, like, you end up like Neil Brown, who's the second name mentioned, like, for all these jobs. It's like, oh, here's the candidate that we want. And, like, oh, Neil Brown is also on the list. Like, you don't want to end up there, but, like, I doubt he will with, like, his history. But, like, he's a really interesting, like, candidate for, like, a lot of these places. I'm really interested to see what type of places he gets thrown out at besides Louisville. So I think he could be a good fit anyway, just, like, with his, like, recruiting ties and, like, obviously he's a great coordinator. Like, so... like, the defense will get better no matter where he goes, probably.
Yeah, I think really it's going to be Big Ten or SEC or ACC. I feel like Big 12, Pac-12, like, I feel like Fickle's bread and butter is the Cincinnati market. And it's not like you're going to recruit the Cincinnati market from USC. Like, he could probably have the same kind of impact and make similar relationships, but, I mean, he could basically harvest the Cincinnati market from Michigan State and pull in among the region's best recruits into Michigan State if he wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to have options regardless. It's just going to be interesting to watch what he does this year, just because, like, it's such a... there's instant gratification, and then there's patience. Which way does he lean? I mean, none of us know him. I suspect that he is a guy who's willing to be patient and wait for his opportunities. But, you know, if somebody throws $5 million in your face, I mean, I'd think hard about it, even if it's a terrible job.
Yeah. I mean, That's one of the advantages that UC has, just real quick. It's one of the advantages that UC has is that they are paying Fickle something like, what, like $3 million, something like that, bonuses all in. Like, $5 million isn't that much more than $3 million, especially if you're looking at, like, I don't know, like Georgia Tech or something like that. That's a tough rebuild. Sorry, go ahead, Scott.
I was just going to throw out, like, the bigger picture, just being in this conference. Like, there's a ceiling to this league, like, which is unfair, but it's true.
There is.
Like, no matter how well you do, like, you're only going to be seen in such a light. And that light is, what are you going to do once you leave here? And, like, if Josh Heupel does well next year, once he proves it as a head coach, like, he'll be a hot candidate for a job, just like Norvell has been a hot candidate at a lot of these jobs at Memphis. Like, if you win in this league, you're going to get a job. And he's won 10 games at it when nobody thought he would. And he can go undefeated 2 years in a row and you're not going to be in the playoffs. So, like, you have to kind of look bigger if you want, if you have big dreams.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's a matter of timing your peak. Not so much that you can actually do it, but if you time your peak with a year when, you know, let's say next year Clay Helton gets, you know, does what Clay Helton does, which is not a lot, gets fired, and USC, for the first time since they hired Pete Carroll, decides to go outside the USC tree and takes James Franklin. And Penn State comes offering $5 million a year to start as your base salary. That's, I mean, like Penn State has its own issues. Like, there are no perfect jobs in the sport outside of, like, five. But Penn State is pretty high up there, right? Like, it's got its issues, including a completely deluded and irrational fan base. But it's, you know, that diluted and irrational fan base is very generous, and they give a lot of money. So you're going to have things, you're going to have all the new toys. But you're taking on a whole new checklist of problems that you didn't have to encounter at a school like Cincinnati. You know, that's not good or bad. It's just different. Like, every job has its problems. It's just the problems are never the same. So if he keeps this run up, his name's going to be out there for the next couple of years. Now, if he, you know, goes 28-0 over the next 2 years and decides, you know what, I'm fine here, I'm not going to move on, and you see he finds the money to pony up, you know, $3.5 or $4 million a year, which it's possible. It's not likely, but it's possible. But if you do that after that run, then you're pretty much saying, yeah, this is where I'm going to be long term. And I'd be perfectly fine with that. It's more about what he wants. And, like, all of these guys are competitive as hell and want to, and a lot of it, especially when it comes to contracts, it becomes a dick swinging contest. I think we all inherently know this. But it's just, how much does he buy into that? How much does he want to do that? We don't really know. And I don't take comments made in the media all that seriously, just because, you know, there's always an agenda. You're always trying to accomplish something when you open your mouth and you speak to a journalist. And we're just not going to know. Like, we're watching this from, you know, a detached perspective. We're fans. And, you know, we don't really know anything, because nobody really knows anything.
That's a great point. No coach is like, oh, I'm going to leave this school. See you later, guys. I don't plan on staying here long. But to Chris's point earlier, I would have been more worried about the Purdue opening than I am about him going to Louisville, even though I think Purdue is a lesser job than that, and just because I don't think you can win at Purdue very much. And Purdue didn't want to drop off, obviously, so they just paid Brahm a ton of money. I think they definitely would have come after Fickell, and I think that would have kind of been a hard job to turn down. But good thing it's not open.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, Purdue, we can go down this road forever talking about jobs, just because I find this to be fascinating, just because I'm a student of decision making, and what people do in these situations is inherently fascinating to me. And that's just kind of, that's me. That's how I'm wired. I just want to know what people do. But, like, Purdue, on the one hand, is not a good job, because you will never compete with the the big boys on the east side of the conference. You're never going to compete with Ohio State, Michigan, Penn State, Michigan State consistently. That's just not what you're going to do. On the other hand, your overlord is Wisconsin. It's Wisconsin. How hard is it to be better than Wisconsin? Not that hard. Like, you're Purdue. You've done it before. Why can't you do it again?
That's kind of what's surprising about Brohm turning down Louisville. Louisville really has an opportunity there to do what Bobby Petrino did with Lamar Jackson, was compete for ACC titles. With Purdue, you could win 8-9 games. You might be able to steal one or two from like Penn State or Ohio State or Michigan or Michigan State, every year, like one win from those four schools. But competing for a Big Ten East title and winning the Big Ten in general, that is a tough task. And with Purdue's resources, oof.
Well, okay, so on the one hand, yes, the ACC with Louisville is a better chance to compete. On the other hand, you have a fucking 10,000-pound gorilla in your division that's not going anywhere. It's kind of a problem.
Yeah, but you have like two of those in the Big Ten.
But not in your division.
Well, they're always going to be in the way, right?
Clemson is not going anywhere. Like, they will be Clemson for the foreseeable future because Dabo's not going anywhere. None of his coordinators, all of his coordinators are exceptionally well compensated and don't have any interest in going anywhere. Like, Clemson is going to be the overlord of that conference going forward. They just are. And that's in your division. So, yes, you have a higher ceiling because you're in the ACC and there are some weaker teams there. With the right schedule breaks, you can, reel off some 10-11 win seasons every year. But Clemson's not going anywhere. Like, Clemson is there to rule for the foreseeable future.
But that's the thing, is like, you're talking about Louisville facing Clemson every year. If you're Purdue and you're winning the West every year, you're always facing that Clemson-type team in the Big Ten championship team, in the Big Ten championship game, whether it be Ohio State, Michigan, or Penn State.
No, I
if you're
I
at Louisville,
that. I get that.
I will fight you over this.
No, I get what you're saying, but if you're Louisville, you're not beating Clemson to win the division. You had your best chance and you didn't take it.
I know, but like, and I hate that we're freaking going, God damn it, Matt, you went down this rabbit hole. My point is that you're either facing Clemson in your division at some point down the road, or you're facing Clemson in your conference title game. It doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Like, you're at Purdue or you're at Louisville. You're either facing Ohio State, Michigan, and Penn State in the conference title game and probably losing, or you're facing Clemson every year in your division anyways. It's, it's a rock and a hard place. What the hell are we talking about?
I don't know, but that turned into a lively debate. That was entertaining.
Yeah. I would say if Louisville didn't have all of those underlying issues, I don't know why Brohm didn't go there. But there's something else going on there, and it's just very telling that he stayed at Purdue.
Yeah, I think the underlying issue is they went 2-10 and got 50 points hung on them like every week. It's like that's a pretty big underlying issue.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they were not competitive for large portions of the year.
Yeah. What's this podcast again?
Let's move on real quick to talk about the AAC awards. Mackenzie Milton, Offensive Player of the Year. A quarterback has won that award every year, unsurprisingly. Nate Harvey, East Carolina, won the Defensive Player of the Year. Kind of surprised since he's like off the radar name. He had 24 tackles for loss. I know we mentioned that last week, but it just stands out so much. Led the nation, even though he didn't do anything against UC. They still have a game left. Isaiah Wright, the first non-Memphis player to win Special Teams Player of the Year. And more importantly, Desmond Ridder, Rookie of the Year, Fickell Coach of the Year, as Chris mentioned. Bearcats had Dino Boyd, first team tackle, Broughton, first team, defensive tackle, Perry Young, first team, and James Smith, first team. James Smith, also a Ray Guy finalist, so he'll be at the College football awards show. So good job, James Smith. Did anything surprise you guys about these awards?
I mean, Chris, do you want to say it or do you want to say it?
Where the fuck was Michael Warren on the first team offense? Like, I'm going to steal this tweet from Stuart Gilchrist. Oh, God. Raquel Armstead, Temple's running back, had 198 yards on the ground. Warren had 1,098 yards on the ground. Warren had 1,163. Armstead has 13 touchdowns. Warren, 17. Armstead had 52 yards receiving. Warren had 224 and a touchdown. What? Explain that to me. Exactly.
He had 6 touchdowns in the game, Armstead. That's the only game the coaches watched.
God. Like, if you're voting for these teams, at least line up the players and look at their stats before you place a vote, for God's sakes.
Well, this is a classic career achievement, not necessarily for the year. I mean, Rock Armstead has been a really good running back for a very long time. But he's a senior, and he hasn't really had I don't think he's been first team before. So, you know, they just kind of threw him a bone. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Go ahead,
Scott.
He hadn't been on any team before, which is kind of surprising. But go ahead, Chris. What was the rest of your point?
No, and I think that's it. I think they basically just kind of first of all, if you look at the first team offense, it's like 98% juniors and seniors. So very heavily upperclassmen, which is, you know, to your point, Matt, it's they're kind of throwing a bone at the guy leaving. And they're setting up Michael Warren to basically be a first-team shoe-in for the next 2 years. He should have been there this year, but that's what they're doing.
In just conference games, Armstead had 671 yards, 9 touchdowns in 6 games. Second in the conference in average per game. Warren had 728 yards and 9 touchdowns in one more game. It's like Warren's numbers were overall better. That one is actually a surprise to me. Like, I don't really understand that, just besides giving Temple, like, the head nod, I guess.
Yeah. So there's that. I was surprised to see Dino Boyd on first team. Like, he had a good year out of nowhere. I don't think anybody really had any expectations for him being an FCS transfer. But he was outstanding all year long. Marquise Copeland... I was expecting a little bit more recognition for him. I think he was only honorable mention. And, like, he didn't have
a good year. He was second team.
Oh, he was? Okay, I missed that.
Yeah.
So that would have been my only complaint, but I guess I really don't have one.
Yeah, my only surprise was probably, and I'm going to explain this in a second, I was a little surprised to not see Brian Wright on the second team. Only because, like, optically, I feel like Wright is always in and around every single play, either jawing at another player or actually tackling them around their legs. So, like, optically, I kind of thought, oh, Brian Wright's probably a shoe-in to be on the first or second team, and he wasn't anywhere on there. And then you kind of look at the stats, and you're like, yeah, it probably kind of makes sense. He was kind of, like, middle of the conference in terms of, like, tackles, didn't really get that many sacks or tackles for loss. I don't think he had a pick. So that was the one where, like, I kind of going into this voting without any stats to look at, I kind of thought Wright would have been on one of the first or second teams, but then when you actually, like, look into it, it's, like, fairly obvious why he didn't make it. But other than that, hey, I mean, no real major surprises.
Well, DeGuara, you could have made the argument that he was best tight end in the league.
Yeah.
That's the only other one I really have.
Like, on the flip side, his stats did fall off quite a bit as the season went along. And Wick Wilcox had, like, kind of similar numbers. I don't know. That one you could go either way with. I was surprised. That was my biggest surprise, too, was DeGuara didn't make the first team. He ended up on the second team, along with Garrett Campbell, Michael Warren, Copeland, back-to-back second teams for Copeland, Kiamani Fitz, and James Wiggins, all second team as well.
Yeah, I mean, good to see Wiggins get recognized because he's something else. I can't wait to watch him for two more more years, but I think it might be one.
Yeah, the only other one that was, like, maybe surprising was, like, seeing Isaiah Wright as a special teams player of the year over over James Smith, who, like Tia mentioned, here's the point, Scott. I mean, he potentially could be the win the award for the best punter in the country, and, you know, he's not special teams player of the year. But, I mean, on the other hand, you know, Isaiah Wright, he took two punts back for touchdowns this year. He took a kickoff back for a touchdown this year. He was, like, one of the most dynamic playmakers in the conference in general. I mean, that's kind of like, you're probably kind of splitting hairs there, but yeah, that was a potential other surprise I know some UC fans were complaining about.
Like, if you take three kicks back, you're probably going to win it. Just like a dude on Memphis did the last couple of years, Tony Pollard. I was about to say a punter never won the award, except Memphis's punter shared the award the first year, so it's possible. Just a shun to James Smith. Underlooked.
It'll probably be like James Smith, like, next year or his senior year, unless someone like a Marty Gilliard type return person, you know, emerges over the next 2 years.
Well, it'll probably be on Memphis.
Yeah, that's usually how it goes.
One more quick note about this before we look at the league real quick. The rookies of the year that sit in this league, John O'Korn, Houston, ended up playing at Michigan, so I'll say that was a good one. Marlon Mack in the NFL, Tre'Quan Smith in the NFL, Ed Oliver is going to be a first-round draft pick, and T.J. Carter of Memphis. So, like, pretty good company for Desmond Ridder. The league has had a lot of good players.
It's a really good football league. It's just not as respected as it should be.
Yeah. When's the media deal up?
Day one. So it's going to be tough to overcome that unless they just keep beating people's brains in for 10 years. Then it might change.
Until they basically get as much money as, I mean, not they're not going to get as much money as a P5, but if they can, like, double, triple, or quadruple their annual earnings, which they might. They might. I mean, things are looking in a solid direction. They're going to always be kind of looked at as the little sisters of the boar. And, you know, until they actually are able to finally compete for a Power 5 or for the college football playoff, which is probably never going to happen unless they get an auto bid, it's going to be – it's always going to be an uphill climb.
Yeah, let's just dive right into that. Real quick, Central Florida last week destroyed South Florida, but Mackenzie Milton had a horrific knee injury. Ended his season. They played Memphis, who destroyed Houston in the West Division game of the year, I guess. Central Florida is only a 3-point favorite, and now there's, like, rumors if they lose, not rumors, I guess, like, murmurings, if they lose, that the American could just lose the auto bid to the Mountain West, since who is at Boise State plays Fresno State. So UCF would have to drop a ton for that to happen, but it's kind of sad, like, he gets injured, and then all of a sudden it's, like, the whole conference, it seems like it's getting devalued.
Yeah, that's how it goes. That's how I feel like the committee basically needs an excuse to drop them, and that might just be it. Go ahead, Matt.
No, I mean, like, if they lose, they're done. Like, Memphis isn't going to get in. They're not going to give the Group of Six bowl to a 9-4 Memphis team. They're just not.
Yeah, but Central Florida, even if they lose, they'd be 11-1. The best Boise State or Fresno State could be is 11-2. But Fresno State's ranked 25th, amazingly ranked 25th, making their return to the polls by before their title game against number 22 Boise State. Like, wow, who would have guessed that happens? And, like, UCF is at number 8. Do you think they'd really drop them that
far? Well, wait a minute. Isn't there a clause like the Access Bowl participant has to win their conference?
Well, one of those teams would win their conference. Oh, I don't know. Oh, yeah, I don't know.
But that's the thing, is like, if Memphis wins the conference and Boise State wins the conference, Boise State's higher rated.
Okay, I stand corrected.
Is that something? No, but is that something? I have no idea. I heard something about that, but...
Yeah, I expect some very interesting officiating in Orlando. Because that's a lot of money. It's a lot of money that would be disappearing if Memphis wins. I'm not saying
it's a conspiracy, but that something?
That's a lot of money.
But is that a thing that, like, if the Access Bowl participant out of the G5 is to have a conference ring?
I don't think it is. I think it's just the highest rated G5 team.
Okay, well, then in that case, maybe. I mean, Memphis isn't bad. If Memphis loses, or if Memphis beats UCF handedly, UCF's going to get jumped by whoever wins in the Mountain West. But if it's close, maybe the committee shows them some mercy. I don't know.
Well, I don't know how they can jump them like 10 spots, because there are not, like, there's not that many games this weekend. A lot of the teams in the top 25 are not playing. So are you really going to, you know, drop all those teams because somebody else in a conference that you clearly don't care about or watch won a game?
Yeah.
I mean, will they? Probably. But, you know. Let's just say the whole system is corrupt and stupid.
No doubt about that. I mean, I guess anecdotally, let's say UCF comes out a Saturday 11-1 against a 11-2 Boise State. 11-1 is better than 11-2, but I just this feeling I have that the committee is just using any kind of excuse they could possibly have to say that UCF isn't as good as they say they are. They'll use against them.
Okay,
that national championship stuff.
To Chris's point, it is the highest ranked champion from a Group of Five conference. So if Central Florida loses, they'd automatically be out.
Ah, shit.
Okay, so that's
that makes it easier.
But they would drop behind those teams, I think. If they lost, they would fall a ton, to Matt's point. Because they're behind a two-loss team that just got, like, their ass handed to them, like, last week. Like, they're 11-0, and, like, they're treated like a joke.
Yeah, they sometimes don't do themselves any favors, though. But, yeah, they're getting the screw job by the committee.
The spread in that game is 3. Like, which way are you guys leaning to that one? That game, if you don't remember, the game earlier this year, Memphis had a huge first half, but didn't score the entire second half, and UCF won 31-30.
I think UCF is still going to do it. I think home field matters. It doesn't matter for everybody, but they're one of the teams where it matters. But not having Milton, just their margin for error is very, very slim, right? You know, going into this game. Mac is fine, but he's not McKenzie.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, like the one of the main reasons UCF came back and beat Memphis on the road in that monsoon was because of McKenzie Milton's magical right arm. And they don't have that on Saturday. And, yeah, they get Memphis at home, but that's very, very shaky. I don't know. If Memphis won that game, I wouldn't be the least bit surprised.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. Playing at home definitely helps. It's like Mac looked pretty shaky on the road. Like, his passing stats weren't great. They were just able to run the ball a ton against Central or against South Florida, pardon, and hit, like, big plays. Like, McCray had a really good game.
Well, I mean, that's like their game plan is completely different with Mac. It is all about the run game. Because, and if I'm Memphis, I load up against the run. But, you know, it's Memphis. Their defense isn't that good. That probably will backfire on them. But that's their only way, is to take that away, because they know coming into this game that UCF's entire goal is to just run the ball down their throat.
And then flip side, that's exactly what Memphis wants to do as well. Like, we saw it in the first game, and obviously they have like a NFL running back who had monster games pretty much every week of the season, including last week. He had 178 yards, 2 touchdowns, and they ran all over Houston for 400 yards. So it's going to be really interesting to see who can keep the ground game going in that game. It's like, it should be a really a good game. Like, the last two times they've met, it's been a ton of fun.
Yep. It's going to be a good one.
Is there any scenario if Georgia, Ohio State, Oklahoma,
no,
all lose?
No.
No, I will. No, uh-oh. Let me finish.
Nope.
Let me finish.
Nope.
Let me finish.
Finish.
If UCF makes the top four, I'm done.
Oh.
Oh.
Here's UCF's path to the top four. Multiple grizzly plane accidents with that's the case. That's how that happens. That's the only way that happens.
It's like they have to like do like the Georgia Tech like 220 points on Memphis to like have a chance.
Yeah. I feel like if that scenario played out, the committee would just put UCF fifth just to basically give everybody in the G5 a middle finger.
No, if they win this game, I would not be shocked to see them rank fifth in the final rankings. Just to be like, eh, you had a chance. Gotcha. You were close.
See?
Just a little bit.
Just one more year of 12-0 and you'll be right there. God, I hate those guys.
Start the year ranked off like at 19th. But elsewhere in the league, since nothing really important happened. Temple beat UConn. Armstead barely played in that game, which hurt his conference stats. Maybe that's why he was first team. Stats in the other games were good. I don't know. Doesn't make sense.
Well, Warren didn't play last week.
Yeah. I don't know. Who knows? Temple won 57-7. Poor UConn. That Tulsa beat SMU. SMU not bowl eligible, despite Ben Hicks having a good season. He wasn't even honorable mention. Like, poor Ben Hicks, I guess. Then Tulane went for two to beat Navy 29-28. Then they fired their offensive coordinator after the game. But Tulane is going to a bowl game, so good job, Tulane. Do you guys have any thoughts about any of those games at all?
Just in terms of Willie Fritz firing his offensive coordinator, I'm very curious if he stays in his zone option lane or if he goes... He looks to the rest of the West and he's like, "Yeah, I gotta get a passing game. I gotta get someone who can pass the ball."
Well, I think that finding someone who can pass the ball isn't so much in the coordinator as in the quarterback. Justin McMillan can pass the ball a little bit,
but that's not like the. What I'm saying is like that's not the offense.
No, like I don't know. Like if you're a school like Tulane, if you find something that's different and unique about you, just fucking lean into it. That's your only way that you're going to have success at a school like Tulane. It is. You can't win at Tulane doing what everybody else is doing.
Yeah, and that was kind of UConn's problem. They basically sacrificed defense this year for a pass-happy zone read option offense, and yeah, they gave up just 421 points this season, which I think is like an NCAA record.
They were the worst offense in the history of the sport before they even played their last game.
You kind of gave up defense, and then they also gave up offense, which was a real struggle to do, but they pulled it off. So good job, UConn.
Bold strategy, Con. Let's see how it plays out.
If only, hey, at least Randy Edsel cashed that $2,000 check last week.
If only they didn't beat Rhode Island. Like, their season would have just been completely perfect and... Like, so many lopsided losses. Like, their schedule is just crazy to look through.
Did you see that, like, in 20... I think it's 2020. They just scheduled Purdue. And they also played Clemson that year. Are you stupid? Like, what are you doing?
They need that money.
I guess.
They need that money for when they go independent next year.
God, Lord willing.
Yeah, I don't know why Clemson schedules that game. Like, do they really need Connecticut recruiting?
Did they basically not schedule an FCS school and just replace UConn with that? I don't know. I haven't looked at UConn schedule or Clemson schedule. Let's look.
Ooh, is UConn like their version of a SoCon team?
It's 2021, and they do play South Carolina State. So, yeah, I don't know what they're doing. UConn in 2021 plays Wyoming and UConn and South Carolina State at home, goes to South Carolina. And yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, looking at their schedule and their postgame win expectancies, like, it's a beauty to behold. You know what their best performance of the game was? Like, in the game this year was?
What, 11%?
33% against Central Florida, and they lost 56-17. That was their best game.
God.
Oh, wow.
This thing's a beauty. It should be framed and put in MoMA.
And there's a good chance that Randy Edsall signs a 2-year contract extension just like Lovie Smith this year. Got to recruit.
I just stopped it there. That was a good point.